Good afternoon, Justin.
Good afternoon, Bill. How are you?
I'm good. Good to have you back.
Yeah, good to be back.
Justin Green here in the DMZ. Matt Lewis still on sabbatical. Hope to have him back soon. Why don't you tell folks again who don't know where you hail from and how they can find you on the interwebs.
I'm based in Washington, D.C. I'm the web editor for a magazine called The Washington Examiner, and I'm on Twitter at jgreendc. So...
You're always J Green DC, but your handle changes a lot. Is that the handle doesn't change?
My description changes. I'm an aspirational man, so I always put the next 1,000 above my name to see if the people will be foolish enough to get me there.
I see. I'm an old man, so I see things on Twitter that I never fully understand. There's all these in jokes that just whiz right by me.
Good. That's what they're supposed to do.
Now, you definitely have a you're like a young Turk. You're a conservative movement young Turk looking to shake things up, looking to build a better conservative movement. And we have now in the House another incarnation of the Paul Ryan budget, which. You know, as all of the Ryan budgets go, are never expected to become law. And even in this case, it has even I think, less drama because Ryan himself just negotiated a 2-year budget pact with Democrats. So there is even less of an immediate need to have any kind of budget resolution at all. But he still seems to have this interest in going through the motions, having this budget as an intellectual template for the party and for the movement. Mm-hmm. It seems to me, I'm curious to what extent, speaking as a conservative inside the Beltway, to what extent is this budget being seen as that? Is everybody rallying behind it in the same way as they did in other years? Or are people kind of like, oh, there goes Paul Ryan again. This guy's not he didn't lead us to the promised land as VP in 2012. You got folks on the right like Sarah Palin bagging on it because it doesn't cut enough. To what extent does Ryan still have intellectual firepower here that is directing the party?
I'm not sure he's looking and seeking really intellectual firepower. And he had a really good response yesterday to Sarah Palin. He said that in response to her blasting his budget that she should read it and she might like it. She's had a little bit of a problem with supporting or attacking things. She doesn't necessarily have any clue what they're about. But I suppose that's part of the tour of being an ex-governor. Realistically, are the Ryan budget, I think what he's trying to do is to consistently lay out a relatively stable budgetary process that will involve cuts or an appropriate vision that have been supported by Republican leadership enough consistent years before they come into power that when they actually do come into power, that it's something that he thinks they might be willing to congeal behind. Per an election year, putting out a budget right now, I mean, there were quite a few Republican members who were saying, please don't make me vote on this thing. Because whenever you talk about Medicare, whenever you talk about Social Security, a party that has the percentage and demographics of the Republican Party, aka a lot of old people, is going to be very skittish about any kind of budget that really says anything about Medicare and Social Security. He's always been very keen to say, this won't touch you if you're older than 55, and it's going to marginally touch you if you're younger than 55. But I mean, when you talk about changing someone's health plan, as we've seen the last year, they get very unnerved. And when you talk about the possibility that someone's government pension, aka Social Security, may change, or that we're going to change the inflation rate on it, or that when the tax thing is going to change, people get nervous and concerned. So it's very tough for Republicans to consider this an election year. But I think the fact that it is tough enough is part of why he had to do it. If he would have backed off the Ryan plan in 2014 because of concerns about the midterms, and where's it going to go? If your members can't be behind a plan and get reelected, is it ever going to actually come into fruition? So it's sort of
why couldn't Ryan? I mean, it's like they voted on it in the past. There's been I think 3 other versions of this, so they're already on record. It wouldn't be running away from it to not reintroduce it this year. Why couldn't Ryan have said, "Look, we just pass Murray Ryan. We have a two-year budget deal. We don't need to introduce another budget resolution until that two-year window is over. That doesn't suggest an abandonment of the ideal budget. Just you would have a vote on it this year, and you might take some pressure off some of your more vulnerable Republicans. I mean, why wouldn't that be a perfectly fine, pragmatic thing to do that would not be abandoning principle?
Because relatively speaking, if you do that out of fear that you're going to lose those vulnerable Republicans, you're essentially conceding that your plan is untenable.
So this way, he says,
he's laying out a statement of ideology and a statement of this is what we genuinely would like to see over the coming few decades, and it allows voters, if they don't much like it, to kick their congressman out. And so I think his assumption is that if he can hold the House, and if they can manage to grab the Senate, and if time comes, 2016, we grab a Republican president, this is something that has been battle-tested and that is perhaps conceivable. Now, those who survived the wars of 94 and 95 are going to say, good luck, guys. And they're probably right, because, you know, massive, massive changes to the federal government are very tough to make happen. Realistically, we've had, four over the past 100 years? So, good luck.
So, I feel like there's a bit of a disconnect in that. I mean, I think this would be a massive change in the role of government, but Ryan seems to go to great lengths to suggest that it won't be a massive change, and downplay the more dramatic effects of it. He seems to be unwilling to fully articulate what the impact of the budget would be. Do you think that's a fair charge?
Certainly. I think he's learned very well from the current president. So he knows quite well that, realistically speaking, that, for instance, putting Medicare on a voucher program, and that providing people with money to access health insurance of their own, is something that very much frightens older people. And it also very much frightens people who are in the baby boomer generation, who are not yet of retirement age, especially those who've gone through the recession, and for many of them have seen their investments and their savings dramatically reduced, who are feeling less economically certain, and who are perhaps, you know, looking forward quite a bit to a Medicare where it's just like, we're going to pay on a rather limited basis, and the government is going to pick up most of it, and they're going to provide fee-for-service. He knows what that faces, and he knows that even if the system that he's promising is something that is ultimately a good, that he's going to face radical opposition because people don't like change. That's perhaps like the most American of all things, that voters demand change, but they never actually want it. So, and where that takes him, I mean, you could pretty easily look at that budget and transition over to the Obamacare debate itself, because Ryan's plan is, in an odd, contrarian way, dramatically helped by the fact that Obamacare looks like it could perhaps be viable. So, which puts us in a weird position. I mean, if you get to the trumpeting of the fact that the administration claims it's reached its 7 million number, that it has the people, if you're willing to look past the questions that exist about that, for instance, do we have 51 viable pools? Do we have, in each state, do we have a market that has been created and can be successful and longstanding? Have these people actually paid for their insurance? Okay, rather than having simply signed up on a website, do they actually now possess health insurance? Moving beyond those things, the Ryan budget exists upon an idea that is more viable if having Obamacare exchanges is something that is an actual reality. So it's an interesting place to consider.
But the Ryan budget still does this weird half Obamacare repeal thing where he...
Yeah, I'll do. We'll include a link at the bottom. I've written about this in the past that until 2016, every viable candidate is going to say that they're going to repeal and replace Obamacare. And some won't even say replace. But it will be a point of, it would be a litmus test to say that we will repeal the Affordable Care Act.
But in this budget itself, he literally gets rid of all the Obamacare spending, which is correct, mainly the subsidies that go to poor and working poor. But he keeps all the Obamacare cuts. he did that before. That's not necessarily a new structure that he's done. But why would proof of Obamacare's viability abet that plan?
Because no plan ever comes 100% to fruition. The basic problem here is that the Ryan budget assumes a lot of political things that may or may not happen in the next few years, and he will have to deal with those contingencies as they come about. One of them is quite likely that there is enough of a demand for healthcare in this country, particularly healthcare that is subsidized to the point at which it is affordable for young people. I mean, whether or not that is good policy, that there will be Obamacare exchange programs that are viable and working. And so then that will become the new status quo, because there will be new constituencies created that will vehemently oppose further change. You've seen the process. It's very tough to change anything in America. And further, once you have changed something, it's very, very difficult to undo that. That is a lesson learned by the Reagan Revolution. That is a lesson learned by Gingrich and his Contract for America. That's a lesson learned by the Tea Party. So in the sort of the unfortunate reality they're beginning to realize now is that the Affordable Care Act, you know, they may win some congressional seats in 2014. It looks increasingly likely like we will retake the Senate, but are we actually getting rid of the Affordable Care Act? I don't see it. It's just, but there will be the continued linguistic fun. There will be, we're going to repeal it. Bobby Jindal went on the record yesterday, the day before, saying that, of course, we're going to repeal the Affordable Care Act. I mean, like, good luck. I welcome it. I don't think it would be the worst thing sooner rather than later, but it's, as with all things that are fun, at some point you have to grow up and realize they're not going to happen.
I want to explore this more, though I do have some other Ryan budget questions for you.
Sure.
Do you think that conservatives were really surprised that they got 7 million? I mean, I just want to make 2 points with the 7 million number. Number one, it's just people who have signed up on healthcare.gov. It's not necessarily those who've actually paid the premium yet, although I think the assumption is most of them will if they haven't already. It's hard to, it's very rare you would sign up for a plan and not actually pay for the plan.
Do you know many millennials?
What's that?
Do you know very many millennials? I have trouble paying my rent on time. I have to, my landlady, I've told her that she is simply to text me when I'm supposed to give her money. And that basically works out fairly well. So I wouldn't place too much faith in people my age to sign up for something and then to actually give money for it. It's
The pain is actually in the sign up, right? You have to sift through all the different plans and make a decision. I think the actual paying of the premium is the easy part. But also it should be noted that 7 million number is not, there's a deadline extension for some, so you're going to get some folks trickling in after the deadline.
Mm-hmm.
And that number doesn't include the state-run exchanges. That's just federalhealthcare.gov, which covers the states where the governors and the state legislators didn't do their own exchanges. So you're going to have a bunch of other numbers from other exchanges that haven't been counted yet. So that number is, I think, is more likely going to go up than go down. But people are still taking the 7 million number as a general sign of early success. And I guess my question to you is, are conservatives all that surprised? Because to me, the bigger test of Obamacare success is, you know, long-term, you know, cost controls and affordability, which you can't discern in a year. But the fact is, there is a legal obligation to buy health insurance now. Therefore, even if it wasn't literally this year, because this year the individual mandate penalty is relatively soft, it actually gets much stiffer by 2016. I mean, people were always going to get insurance. That really shouldn't be all that shocking to anybody. But it seems like people were genuinely shocked. So what's the mindset in conservative world now? Is it, oh my God, this actually might work, we have to now recalibrate our whole game plan here? Or do people think it's still a house of cards, they can just plow through with the strategy they've been going with?
I want to split that question, I guess. The first is that I don't understand the idea that people weren't going to get insurance. I mean, there are inevitably these things are going to happen, particularly when you subsidize them at a rate that you do to draw in the young people that you need to do it. The demographic numbers that I have heard of, that I've talked to people that I can't get confirmed because, you know, getting confirmation from the government is incredibly difficult, tell me that essentially, I mean, they're not what they were hoping for in terms of the young and the healthy. And realistically speaking, young is less important than healthy in terms of a risk pool for insurance. And you can have sick young people too. You need healthy people to balance out the people who are not. I think the number that actually matters is less about getting the people in the pools. It's about controlling their premiums, and that definitely remains to be unseen, because the Affordable Care Act promised to do a few things, and unfortunately it can't do all of them, because, well, at least in any conceivable sense, it promised to expand insurance to nearly everyone. It promised to lower the cost of insurance for nearly everyone, and it promised to, I don't even know how to put this in a way without like laughing, it promised to leave people's basic standards of service relatively intact. And that three-legged stool of promises, they can't all go together unless you have like magical beans. Which leaves us in a place where most people are now going to have or be able to access in some way health insurance. So you have one stool that will stand up. But what that will do is that it will mean for many families, particularly those who are above the threshold for subsidies, are going to be paying significantly more for their insurance. And those are the ones who I think the GOP is targeting the most, because they're the ones who are going to be unhappy with the results of the ACA. And the goal is that people will be unhappy enough that their premiums will spike to a certain extent to which they may be willing to change their voter registration or even to change their vote. So that, I think that's where the ACA goes in 2015, 2016, and beyond, is does it actually control the growth of healthcare inflation? And if it does not, I don't think it will be terribly successful.
And so, I mean, that's certainly a fair critique of a possible scenario, but it would take, you know, some time to see if that actually was borne out. Whereas you see Republicans now just itching to find stories of Obamacare disaster, and they seem to have jumped on a lot of early anecdotes that haven't panned out. And they set a very low bar for early success with this early enrollment period, and now which has now been cleared. So is this undermining their credibility? Is it making them change their strategy? Are they at least considering maybe we should just take a step back and let this play out for a time and see if people really like it or don't like it after it's actually been in effect, and then we can decide if we want to pile onto it or not. And for now, we can talk about something else. Is there any sense of the strategic gear shifting?
Well, Bill, you're a fairly astute political observer, and you know that would never happen. So you can look at it a few ways. You can say yes, and like an ideal technocracy, we might say, you know, sure, we're going to give it like a decade and see if it plays out. See if we can transition from a free fee for service to a fee for care program, to see if we can begin to control some of the cost spikes that occur in our sickest and oldest, and to, you know, that's not a death panels thing. That's a fact that the vast majority of our healthcare spending is on a tiny fraction of the population, and on a way to see if we can take care of them better, or if there are ways that we can be smarter with our spending, if there are ways in which we can make the cost that they provide be less of a strain on the overall system. But that's not the way our politics work. And if programs that take a while to hang, they're going to have to build constituencies very fast. Where the GOP definitely failed to be creative and smart was in reckoning with the fact that there was going to be a massive Medicare expansion. The Affordable Care Act is the Affordable Care Act is an expansion of Medicaid that is combined with some messing with the individual insurance market. That's essentially what it is. And it's worked fairly successfully. They've added millions to the rolls of Medicaid. Now, as to how to deal with that, I think that people like Ovik Roy and Philip Klein have offered a path forward for Republicans on that issue, that once we eventually deal with the fact that the Affordable Care Act is a thing, that it will survive, and unless, you know, the magical beans come out to play, that you can use it to a certain extent in the sense of giving fairly substantial tax credits to people who are on Medicaid to go purchase healthcare on the individual insurance exchanges. That is, I think, a fairly viable option. And it would probably be best done, not on a state level, but on a national exchange, so we can build the biggest pool possible. So this is where we get into fun issues, such as like, what is the minimum standard of care? What is the minimum? How should we judge what should and should not be insured? All these fun issues that you thought we had played out in 2009, 2010, that were taken in Supreme Court, that we're still having fun with, they will persist for some time to come. But it's just it's a big, hot, very fun mess.
Now, I wrote a piece yesterday. First, Jonathan Cohn wrote a piece of the New Republic talking about all the conservative politicians and commentators that made these very grandiose Obamacare predictions, how it was all going to collapse, and now have been proven wrong. I wrote a follow-up piece to that saying, yes, but let's not forget who drove the alarmist coverage, you know, in the fall, which was not really coming from conservative quarters. It was coming from Ezra Klein, who was at the Washington Post running Wonk blog. Now he's starting up Vox.com. But I think it was his and his team's tone and direction coming off of the early website problems that seemed to validate what conservatives were saying, validate this whole notion of a bumbling, incompetent, big government, clumsy behemoth, and led to this very low bar being set for the early enrollment folks to clear. And I was writing at the time that it's not unusual for government programs to have rough launches. There's actually a number of parallel things that happened with Social Security in the late 30s. You know, in particular, this whole notion of there's this whole panic that the Obamacare data that they were giving to the insurance companies was flawed, that they're giving them bad personal data and it was going to screw everything up. And there's a very similar concern in Social Security days with it was called the John Doe problem, that the employers were not giving good enough data to the federal government about people's wages, and therefore they wouldn't be able to have good wage records to calculate their benefits.
Mm-hmm.
But in both cases, the problem was recognized, and the bureaucracy studied what to do about it and slowly chipped away at it and resolved it. And it seems like this is a similar situation, you know, writ large. Problems were flagged. Problems happened. Good people looked at it, made fixes. Yeah. Things worked out. And this tone from the beginning that it must be a scandal, it must be some rank incompetence, and you know, Ezra had a whole thing, you know, who is going to get fired, head should roll, all that kind of stuff. That seemed to, coming from a quote-unquote liberal opinion journalist, seemed to validate the broader media to run wild with that tone of coverage, when at the end of the day, it wasn't a fatal flaw. It was something. It was a problem. It was a fixable problem, and it got fixed.
Okay, so I'll pose this question to you then. Do you think if there hadn't been an outcry from respected people on the left, that the administration would have got its act together so quickly?
Sure.
I think that's ridiculous, Bill. I mean, the perception... I remember responding to this as well at the time happening. There were responses written by people I very much like you know, Zerlina Maxwell wrote something. Joan Walsh, who I don't care so much for, wrote the scathing lead piece on the issue. I mean, Ezra wrote that it was very troubling that an administration that came in promising to herald a new era of technology and vision and being able to handle bureaucratic challenges fell so completely flat on its face, and it was absurd and laughable. I for one, laughed loudly at the rollout of healthcare.gov because it was embarrassing. And I think that when the government is embarrassed, especially one that is so full of itself, it's fun and enjoyable and should be mocked. But largely because of that rollout and response that it got, the administration got its act together and managed to put together a website on a very expedited process that managed to get 7 million people enrolled by the 1st of April. So I think, like, saying that Ezra was somehow problematic for calling out what was a clearly problematic thing is not you guys' best move, probably.
No, I don't feel that was a catalyst. I mean, I think the problems were significant enough that it wasn't a secret. I mean, I think they were well aware that people were going on the website and couldn't log on.
There are people who were saying that it wasn't a problem. I mean, the problem that they faced was that there are people saying, no, this is not a problem. Don't worry about this.
It took them until the
31st of March to get the signups they needed. So, you know, if they had taken off December as well, they might not have gotten there. And, you know, of course, the administration was willing to forgive this and say, you know, if you click a little blue checkbox on healthcare.gov saying that you tried to get your health insurance, you know, good to go. I mean, if you put that aside, they kind of took it right to the marker, which is, again, I think as much of anything, the fact that young people know perfectly well how to use the internet and were very fine waiting until 31st of March to get their health insurance. But you know, well, at the same time, sometimes you need to get your stuff together.
I mean, that's one of the reasons why it wasn't really a panic situation. There was time to fix this problem. People did not need to get their health insurance in October. And it seems like there are certain kinds of problems that you just weren't going to be able to beta test until the site was live. Problems manifested once.
Well, you do remember right at the end of December, though, correct? During December, there was a concern that those who had their policies canceled weren't going to be able to have health insurance by the 1st of January. There is going to be a coverage gap created because of the rank incompetence of the administration. Now, this is a significantly smaller chunk of the population than we ultimately have, but there are still quite a few people who received cancellation notices saying, as of January 1st, you don't have health insurance, but couldn't get on healthcare.gov and buy health insurance. So, I mean, it was, sometimes you need your feet held to the fire.
Those folks got extensions, right?
Did they?
I thought they made provisions to say if you got a cancellation notice and you are unable to sign up, you are not going to get an individual mandate penalty because of that. We will work with you over.
I don't think the mandate penalty was the real concern. The concern was that people wouldn't have health insurance.
I'll have to go back and look at the details. I don't remember the exact particulars of it, but be that as it may, I'm not suggesting there were not problems here. I'm not suggesting the problems were not worthy of coverage. I'm saying that the problems should not have been treated as a scandal that required hysteria.
I don't know. I would have fired Sibelius today of it. Sorry. I mean, that's, maybe that's just a difference in the approach. But the Obamacare was promised as this new age of how we can solve these big problems and we can handle these big issues because we now have computers and big data that can handle all these issues that we previously thought were unhandleable. It was a pretty bad experience.
You don't learn until you have these experiences. I mean, when Social Security started, they didn't have the punch card technology needed to do it. They had to learn it. They had to make mistakes in doing it to get to that point.
Except in 2009, they promised that we knew how to do this. I suppose it's the difference.
Well,
I don't know. You can talk about like expectations versus what you should reasonably demand from your government. But the problem is that a lot of this was premised on the idea that we knew how to do it and that it was going to be no problem and that we're going to be good to go.
You might be expanding this promise a little too broadly. I mean, I think the promise is we know.
The promises are on video. We can insert the supercut of the promises that Obama laid out very nicely. I mean, they were quite explicit and repeated enough times you might suspect he believed them. So,
well, again, I mean, they are able to create a website that people can log on to. It exists today.
Correct. Interestingly enough, I mean, I think I could do, that was the amusing thing, which is the fact that I suppose you should not expect more from a .gov website, but good to go, fine, whatever. I'm glad that I can finally stop trying to correctly, I've messed up the spelling of healthcare so many times when I'm trying to type out healthcare.gov that I'm glad this is done. And hopefully we don't talk about this much in the near future because we transitioned to phase two of the Affordable Care Act. So it's going to be interesting. We're going to see if they can control rate shock. We're going to see how tenably we managed to begin the unwinding of employer-subsidized insurance. We're going to see if they get rid of the employer mandate. As Gibbs was hinting at today, the White House hit back pretty hard. We'll see if anything comes of it. I think the White House is fairly good at floating these little trial balloons with Biden or with other outside figures that if they're well-received, they proceed, and if they're not, they don't. That's not smart politics, like plus one White House. Good job, guys. But we'll see. I think ultimately it's odd in a weird way. The viability of the Ryan plan depends to a certain extent on how much Obamacare succeeds. Because if it fails, it's going to be very, very difficult to convince the American people to take the YOLO approach and jump into another massive change to the way our federal government is involved in our lives.
Well, this gets back to my old point about the coverage. Because any kind of change is going to have hiccups.
When you promise no hiccups. That's sort of and that's where Republicans get really tricky by promising that it's not going to be a big deal. Because these things, unfortunately, are a big deal.
I'm sure there are other quotes that Obama has made where he said there's going to be changes to make along the way too. That not everything is going to be perfect all the way through. I mean, you can cherry pick lots.
I've watched a lot of raw video, and he's pretty optimistic about it. I mean,
he's still optimistic. No one has gotten pessimistic about the entire thing. But the point is that any kind of big change is never going to go 100% smoothly. This is true in the public sector. This is true in the private sector. That's just life. And the question of what should the Obamacare healthcare.gov experience teach us
is not to ever do it again. Yes, thank you.
Well, I mean, I don't think it says that. I think it says that change is worth doing. You don't learn until you try. You need to have institutions that do new things if they're going to learn and get better and get smarter and get more functional and more effective. If you say that anything you do involves too much political risk, that we should stay stagnant and static forever,
I wouldn't advise doing that. I think that's chicken. I mean, that's foolish. I would like to do some fairly radical things to our federal government and the way that our federal government is involved in our lives. I wouldn't lie about it, though, I suppose. And that was sort of the lesson that I've learned from this, is that we passed through a big, substantial change in the way the federal government is involved in our lives. And the President of the United States repeatedly lied to the American public about what it would do to their relationship with the federal government and with their relationship to their health care. Well, it's done. YOLO, congratulations. Fantastic. But, you know, part of being in politics is recognizing that reality is here. So it's from now, what do you do? So there's some big questions that are going to be faced by the GOP. And there's, as I told you earlier, I mean, you're going to hear the words repeal until repeal is no longer a possible thing. And repeal is, well, it has not been a possible thing since November, but people won't truly realize that until 2016, 2017. So,
well, to segue out of Obamacare, back to Ryan Budget for a second. What do you make of? Let me put it this way: this is sort of the dream budget. This is meant to be, you know, the conservative utopia of what is possible. And even with that, even with $5 trillion in spending cuts over 10 years. Even with the non-defense discretionary spending going below Reagan-era levels in a 10-year time frame, but to achieve this arbitrary goal of a complete balanced budget, no budget deficit in 10 years, mm-hmm. he has to resort to an accounting gimmick using the ideological premise of dynamic scoring, which is you say that this tax cut is going to create this much new revenue because of the economic growth that's going to create, which is a philosophy that the Congressional Budget Office really does not adhere to. They tend to try to play things more cautiously. But Ryan, and it uses that in a way he did not use in past budgets to get to budget balance in 10 years. If I was a conservative, that would make me say... with cuts this deep, we are hacking away here, and we still can't get to this arbitrary goal that we have in our heads as being important in the time frame we think is necessary. What does that say about the goals that we have? Are they actually reasonable goals if you can't actually do it with normal math? Does that unnerve anybody in your side of the pond?
I guess the question is, what did the left side of your party want in 2007 and 2008 with healthcare? What did they get? And what did they get? And sort of the response I get is that we have a politically powerful wing of our party that wants far more than it can possibly get. Even if we take control of the House, even if we get 60 votes in the Senate, and that's assuming that Harry Reid doesn't take the let's just go to 51 approach. Assuming that we retain our filibuster going into 2016, 2017, even if we have complete control of Washington, we're not going to get a Paul Ryan budget. Now, we might get something that resembles it or something that is incrementally closer to that than what we have now, but you're not going to get a balanced budget in 10 years, nor realistically is that something that's terribly useful. I mean, I don't think prioritizing a balanced budget over, say, a substantial payroll tax cut is something that I wouldn't necessarily want or I think is good. But when you negotiate things, you ask big, and then you assume that you're going to get whittled down. So,
but
if Paul Ryan wants to cut 500, if Paul Ryan wants to cut 500 billion bucks a year over 10 years, and if he walks away cutting 50 or 100 billion dollars over 10 years, you know, that's probably okay.
I take it from your healthcare parallel, though, that you're assuming what everybody on the left wanted in 2007 was single payer. Is that correct?
I'm assuming that what the people who were being pandered to wanted was single payer.
But that's not true. That's not there was no Democratic budget in 2007 that advertised single payer. There never was a major Democratic
presidential candidate. Of course not. Because we're not talking about Paul Ryan's healthcare plan right now. That's the difference.
We're talking about Paul Ryan's budget. We're talking about the
aspirational people on your party and your party base want.
Your parallel there is flawed.
My parallel there is that in politics you want things, you don't always get them, but you shoot for the most that you possibly can imagine because you assume that you'll settle for something less.
Well, I accept that. I think that's
a fair point. I'm not trying to say. I'm of the school that you should be cautious about comparing things unless you're being very obvious that you're not making a direct comparison. So, you know, I've written before on how you don't compare Obamacare to slavery because they're not similar things. You know, and the Paul Ryan budget is not terribly similar to the Affordable Care Act because they're very different things, but the understanding is quite similar, which is that you're going to ask for the moon and you're going to accept an asteroid and hopefully neither hit the Earth. So that's,
but I think it's relevant that you never really had on the left.
Sure you did. You had a request for a public option. That's part of the game.
It's very different than single payer.
Is it really though? Public option that will be dramatically more market competitive than private option that ultimately will fade into something else.
When public option was first, I happen to know this history very well. I mean, number one, when public option was first injected into the discussion in 2007, it was not well known or understood amongst the base at all. It was very much a wonky concept, which Edwards picked up first. And Hillary and Obama then picked up in a very light way. It was not really emblazoned in their healthcare plans, and it was not the main focal point in the 2008 primary debate. The big debate in the primary debate was individual mandate, which Hillary was for and Obama was not. And that was the big argument. And then all of a sudden, all the so-called, I shouldn't say all of, but a good chunk of the left took individual mandate as the ideal because that was truly universal, and somehow Obama was falling short of that because he was not saying there should be a government law mandating everyone would have insurance. But even within that debate, you had a kind of Michael Moore left who was dismissing both those approaches because they were not single payer, and public option was a big sellout because it was leaving the private insurance industry in place. So you have all these factions going on in the left in terms of healthcare, and I would say a pretty widespread of ignorance about what this all meant amongst a large segment of the base. But you never had any kind of establishment Democratic legitimacy to the farthest left position here being single payer, whereas you do have that with Paul Ryan and his budget.
All right. Well, let's establish one thing very, 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 very quickly, which is that there is considerable amount of distance to the right of Paul Ryan's budget.
Well, I want to
lay that out pretty bluntly. I mean, that's the idea. I mean, this is Paul Ryan's naysayers are not Michael Moore. Although I think, unfortunately, some of the naysayers in Michael Moore probably have some similar political beliefs about crazy things. Now, that is Paul Ryan's budget incrementally downgrades things, and it does it over a 30 to 40 year window because it knows that it's not going to happen, or that if you are going to make things happen, you're going to incrementally restrain the growth of government. We're never going to return to an era where federal government spending was 10% of GDP. It's just not going to happen. Now, you might be able to say we're going to slow it, and in 50 years, it's going to be 25% of GDP instead of 35%, and call that a win, which I probably would. But I think in criticizing me about comparing to single payer, you're kind of doing the exact same thing.
No, I take your point. There's gradations there, but I do think when you get to the right of Paul Ryan, you really get into kind of Looney Town.
How? If you want to critique dynamic scoring, I mean, that's fine. Unfortunately, the problem with this is that it's tough to get a good scientific measurement on something that requires you to throw the world's largest economy into a scientific experiment. So that's tricky. It's going to be, I don't know how much it's going to be done, partly because I don't worry too much about it because it's not going to politically happen. There are different debates that we're going to have before the Paul Ryan budget could ever become a thing. It's more of a platform that's been voted on. I would say we're going to do things. We're going to do a tax reform, whether that is corporate friendly or family friendly. We're going to find out pretty quickly. We're going to do things like, for instance, what we decided to do with Medicaid, what we decided to do with Medicare. These things are going to be separately and voted on differently, and they're going to have different political factions come together to support them or to decline them, and we will see. But I think it's just very difficult to treat the Paul Ryan budget as an omnibus thing because it's not, and it can't possibly be because it has too many moving parts, and the Republican Party is not good at passing things that have a lot of moving parts.
I guess the question is, in my mind, it's just as far as political effectiveness is concerned, I think that the Democrats were in a better position to finally get health care passed because they never set expectations wildly high as far as what could be achieved. There certainly is a faction of the left that is still mad that Obama didn't push single payer. But I think that is a delusional part of the left. Right. Generally speaking, most folks were content enough, even though there's grousing about this or that. There's grousing about, some people grouse about the mandate, some people grouse about the benefits that the drug industry got, some people grouse about things that the insurance lobby got. I mean, there's all that grousing you can certainly find. At the end of the day, everybody on the left got together and reelected Barack Obama. They weren't that mad about it when it came down to it. I don't know. I feel the right now has a problem with expectation setting that the Democrats have had a better hand. Obama has had a better handle with keeping the left in check as far as expectations are concerned. Now, the counter argument is that, Ryan is now extending the Overton window and making the potential of what's possible more acceptable because he's planted his flag so far out there. We'll see when the day comes when he and his crew get their run of the office. But I feel at this stage of the game, it's been not politically helpful to them to plant the flag that far out there.
Well, as we're aware, things are difficult. I mean, we ultimately you're going to have our Clinton moment where you have somebody kind of stake back to the middle. I don't know who that person is. I don't know what that looks like. I don't know if that happens in 16 or 20. I think part of the reason the Affordable Care Act happened is because we went into a war we shouldn't have started. And then we also managed to bungle domestic programs as well. So Democrats got handed a hot, hot majority in the House, and you guys got your Senate Democrat and your Senate and your presidency back. And you made it happen your first term. And since then, nada. It's just a. And that's probably not going to happen. I mean, people have the impression that the Affordable Care Act is going to produce the same electoral result as the reaction to going to Baghdad. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't know. I just. But Paul Ryan is no extremist. Paul Ryan has a plan that I think is overly optimistic. But, you know, as with politics, as politicians have to at times feign outrage, sometimes politicians have to be optimistic because they lack other options. And his budget, I think, is a healthy rejoinder to the fact that you both, A, have to vote on things if you want them to become law. You can't just speak about them or write a book or, tweet. But it's also that you have to a certain degree, accept the fact that you're not going to change things overnight. He took a lot of flack because his budget doesn't cut things fast enough. I mean, it's sort of I sit in a spot in the political spectrum where I see Paul Ryan, crazed Randian, who is insane and this policy is nuts, while I'm on the other side, I get to witness people saying, how dare this weak rhino, he's weak, we should banish him for being Republican in name only. The Overton window's moved. It hasn't moved overall, but on our side of the Overton window, it has shifted. I think the balance of gravity has moved significantly to the right as a consequence of the dement wing of the party. And it's my little mini pundit prediction that you guys are going to have one of those of your own. There will at some point be discontent that will move your window as well. And perhaps that will shift the overall Overton window. The United States, for instance, has a remarkably narrow Overton window. Like the political differences you and I openly have are not very significant in any real sense. But at times, you know, these little tiny gradations, as you find in like the Protestant wing of, as you find in like different churches within the Protestant church, the tiny little things, the ones you fight most desperately about. So here we are.
Well, I will leave it on that note. I have a child that refuses to nap that I need to cajole into sleeping. But it's always good to talk to you.
Always good.
And where can folks find you again?
I'm at the Washington Examiner. On Twitter, that's the DC Examiner. You can find me on Twitter personally at jgreendc.
You can find my stuff at Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, also at theweek.com. Always kicking around liberaloasis.com and Twitter at Bill Scher. Back on the DMZ here at bloggingeds.tv next week. We'll see you then.